like to turn now to Agenda Paper 7, dealing with an iForest 2 issue, and then we're going to follow that with a consideration of some other matters on iForest 2 that the Board has addressed to us. So, Denise, you're on for the rest of the day.
I'm glad you're first.
She realized being here for the rest of the day is a good thing.
It's all right, we're here with you as well.
Okay, I would like to move to Agenda Paper 7. And, well, this is not a new topic for you, because this topic was discussed previously at the September and November meetings last year. And at those meetings, the committee discussed the classification of a share-based payment transaction in which the entity withholds a specified portion of the shares for purposes of meeting the statutory income tax withholding requirements. At the time, the committee noted that IFRS 2 provides sufficient guidance to address this issue. However, well, the committee directed the staff to develop an example, a fact pattern that could illustrate the classification and could provide you with a better understanding of the issue that we were analyzing. And also, with the aim also to give response to some of the views that you have addressed at previous meetings. So Agenda Paper 7 contains this fact pattern. And it's important to say that this fact pattern reflects the assumptions of the original submission that the committee addressed at the previous meetings, as opposed to Agenda Paper 7A, which includes a variation of this fact pattern, but is not really addressing the question addressing the question that the committee originally received. So basically, in Agenda Paper 7, what we are saying is that, and that these conclusions are clear in paragraph 39 of this paper, what we are saying is that we think that the manner of settlement is a principle in IFRS 2 that guides the classification of share-based payments. If we are in agreement with that, then we would have a good start here. In the fact pattern that we provided, the entity has chosen to pay the employee's compensation partly in equity instruments and partly in cash. So consistent with the definitions in IFRS 2 and consistent with the principle that I have mentioned and the requirements in paragraph 34 of IFRS 2, the component of the share-based payment award that is settled by the issue of equity instruments will be classified as equity settled, while the other portion that is settled in cash to satisfy the tax withholding requirements would be in substance or would be classified as a cash-settled share-based payment transaction. So again, the conclusion of the staff, again, is that IFRS 2 provides sufficient guidance on this issue. And, well, I would like to open the discussion or see if you have any questions before getting to the questions that I have included in paper 7.
So questions on the example that you worked through?
Yes.
Okay. Any comments or clarifications on what the staff has done on this worked example? We're not asking you the formal questions yet. It's just the way that the staff has taken the example, worked through it, the way that they've analyzed. Anybody, any further questions? Guido?
I have a question to paragraph 32 in the staff paper, which describes a situation where the staff would come to the conclusion that it's all equity settled. And what I understand, number A, so you issue all shares to the employee, and then, but B, one I, that made me wonder what you mean by that, because it seems that if the employer sells the shares, that he already transferred to the employee, and it's not selling it via a third-party brokerage firm, because my understanding is that 1E is it's selling it itself, then you would say it's equity settled. So putting it around, we would say that if the company would be required to sell the shares that are needed to make the cash tax payment, if the company would be required to sell the shares, I don't know whether this requirement should be included in the plan, then it would be all equity settled?
Yes, that's correct. From the company's perspective, they have issued all of the shares. And the financing of the tax obligation has been achieved through the selling of some of the shares in the market. But from the company's perspective, all that they have done really is to issue all of the shares.
Just to make that, because I think that was also included in the discussions we had before, one of the arguments for not splitting it up in cash or equity settled was that, yes, we understand that normally the company has to take its own cash in order to settle the liability, but then the question came, what if the company voluntarily sells the shares that it retained? So it would net, on a net position, they wouldn't take any of their own cash. And I think the staff came to the conclusion, well, that doesn't matter whether they do that voluntarily. Now it seems that if it's required, and that's the word in B, if it's required to sell them, the company is required to sell them, then you would say it's equity settled.
Yes, that's part of the share-based payment transaction. But if there was an independent decision taken by the company separate from the share-based payment transaction to issue shares into the market in order to finance a particular transaction, happened to be the tax transaction, that is a separate transaction and should be accounted for separately, the decision to do that having been taken separately.
Okay, thanks.
Laurence?
Yeah, I'm not convinced by the staff analysis of the example where the staff concludes that there is a cash element that is being paid to the employees. I do not think that the outflow of cash is the driver here for saying that it is equity settled or cash settled. Mm-hmm. Let me just take an example. In a plan that we usually account as equity settled, that the shares are being remitted to employees, in some circumstances, an entity does not have the ability to issue shares, so they will have to purchase the shares on the market because their shareholders refuse that there is no new issuance of shares. So in that case, cash will have to be dispersed in order to remit the shares to the employees. Still, in this case, we conclude that it is an equity settle. Again, building on the example that Guido has been pointing at, imagine that in the case, the day before, the morning before, the company purchases the shares on the market because they are not authorized to issue shares, hand them over to the employees. The employees tell them, sell them on the market so as to get the cash and remit it to the employees. What's the difference, really? I cannot see the difference, and I cannot see this conclusion to say that cash is being given to the employees. So I can't see the cash outflow as being the driver for this to be partly cash settled.
Okay, Laurence, could I ask you, in that example, what is the obligation on the company? Is the obligation on the company to deliver shares, even when they have to go into the market to buy the shares?
Yes.
Yes.
But what's the difference? Because in a case, as if here, for example, you may have the shareholders that allow the board of directors to issue a certain number of awards to employees. Usually the counter
is on the gross number of shares that are being remitted to the employees. It's not on the net number and considering the cash element that is being considered. So this is why I'm saying those elements, considering the fact that I don't see much differences in the schemes depending whether there is an obligation to remit the shares or as long as there is in the counter, the counter is on gross number of shares, I can't see the element of cash being dispersed being the driver to say that a portion is being cash settled.
Okay. Doug?
Yes, I think we go back to the original purpose of IFRS 2, which I argued last meeting. I do not agree with the staff's recommendation now. And the original purpose of IFRS 2 is to keep the comparability and the profit or loss. Some company doesn't have a stock option plan, whereas others has a stock option plan. And if there is a difference, it is the problem. That is the starting point of the IFRS 2. So therefore, in case of equity settled share-based payment, IFRS 2 asks us to measure the service received. So the purpose is to measure the service received, and we should expense it. And then the important point is the service received, which was agreed between the employee and the employer, basically at the date of grant date. So, but in case of withholding tax, on the grant date, agreement is 100% share-based payment, and withholding occurred afterwards, and tax rate may change, and duty of tax withholding may be changed. Say, for example, on the grant date, there was no duty of withholding tax, but at the date of exercise day, government suddenly decided you have to withhold it. Then, does it affect the profit or loss, or does it affect the amount of the service which should be measured and expensed to profit or loss? I don't think it doesn't make a difference. So therefore, I would say this recommendation is against intuitive of my sense of accounting of share-based payment.
Okay, I think we're wandering too far forward. The first question was only to see if there are any concerns you had with the staff analysis of the illustrative example that was in the papers, not with the conclusions that you'll be asked to comment on later. So if we can keep it to that without introducing any more examples and going round in circles, I think it will help us to get to the end more quickly. Ruth?
I was peeking ahead.
Okay. Oh, well, there's no choice of who's left now, then.
I feel so wrong, Bob. No, I'll keep this comment specific to the example. And I think, you know, I've kind of summarized this staff approach as, do we account for this transaction net, or do we account for the two transactions that we're settling net? And so my question relating to the example is the employee has provided $300 to the company. And the staff example notes that the strike price is $3 per 100 awards. So my question is, if you're viewing this as a 60-40 or 66-34, however it ends up being, is that the right way to look at that? That is, an employee is not going to give money for money. They give money for shares. And that's what the terms of the arrangement said. So I guess my question on the example, and just again to get clarity on how you're going to view this, would you value the equity based on 60 shares at a $3 strike, or would you value them at 60 shares at a $5 strike? Because at the end of the day, the employee is giving $300 for 60 shares. So I think if you're going to take the example further and talk about, well, the focus is on the cash flow, then the next question, and I noticed from the staff example, is that the liability is 680, I think, if I remember the number.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it not 680 minus the 300 the company received for the awards? So I think those are two related questions, but I just want to clarify, because it wasn't clear in the valuation discussion in the example. Are you valuing these awards? I mean, again, if you're looking at this as 60-40, all right, or 66-34, I think you have to go the next step, which is to say we're not giving cash for cash. We're giving cash for equity. And I don't know if you could clarify how I would value those awards. Do I value them on a $5 strike or a $3 strike?
Well, IFRS 2 takes the grant date fair value as being the basis for the expense. So that's what would be the starting point. And then to the extent that there is a...
You need strike price for that.
Sorry, but in order to do a fair value, just make it simple, Black-Scholes, right? You need risk-free rates, you need strike price, intrinsic value, et cetera, right? So part of that grant date fair value for an option has to include the strike price in order to calculate
yes. The
intrinsic. So my question is, when you're valuing that award, in this example, right, would you value it based on the stated terms, which is a $3 strike, or would you tell the companies that really what we need to do is calculate an implied strike price?
Sorry,
calculate an implied strike price, which is based on your taxing jurisdiction, you're going to give me 300 for 60, which is no longer a $3 strike price. It's a $5 strike price.
No. In this example, and we tried to make it clear that all 100 options are being exercised, not only 60 for the 60 shares.
Understood, but I think the staff example is that not all 100 shares are being issued. There's shares in cash. And legally, the employee is giving cash for equity, not cash for cash. I think that, again, it's...
No, they're giving cash for the exercise of the options, and they're exercising all 100 options.
Okay, but I think what you're saying there is that you're no longer bifurcating. I think what you're saying with that statement, because, again, you don't have a strike price on cash.
If you had an option that you could choose to settle, the employee could choose to settle in cash or shares, and there's an exercise price, then that still gets built into the valuation.
No. Okay, so I think there's more questions on this example in terms of how you'd value, and then the second question, how you'd actually do the liability. Because if the focus is on how much cash flow from operations, I would think the 300 I received into operations would offset the liability of 680. Or would it not? I mean, those are two complexities in the example.
Yeah. Okay, and maybe that's something to consider in terms of valuing options, but how does that affect the classification?
Mm-hmm. That wasn't Bob's point. I'll talk about how it affects the classification, but I wasn't allowed to ask that. I was supposed to ask about your example. And so my question was post-classification. You've already decided post-classification in the example you bifurcate. So my question is, on the example, how then do you account for the bifurcation? How then do you take the next step? And in both on the valuation of the equity and on the recognition of the liability. I think those are two questions that, on the example, I didn't know if those had been thought through, but it was a question on the example. I can get into the classification, but I'll wait for Bob to...
We'll wait until we get there. No, you raise an interesting point, which I don't think had been considered, that in the circumstances where you're issuing less than the number of shares that is subject to the option, whether or not the total strike price that is paid, because the employee will have to pay the 300 in order to exercise its rights, for which then the company decides to withhold some shares to pay the tax. So I think the end result is probably going to be the same. The mechanics of how you get there, and for those that are involved, I suppose, in issuing these shares, you've got to think about that, because you have only issued, in this example, the 60 shares, but you've received not 60 times 3, but 300 in total. You would still have the same figure in equity, so the amount of the accretion into equity as a result of providing the service, which is earning the grant date fair value of the option, plus the strike price that is being paid as if it was 100 shares, is what is in equity. That's the right answer. And whether you go your way in the example or you go through Aaron's convoluted thinking, but perhaps technically more correct in your jurisdiction, we're going to come to the same point. So it might not change when we come onto the classification, but it's an interesting digression. Shall we just take a question from Scott, and then we can really get to what you want to talk about?
I just wanted to one thing about the example as written in paragraph 13. The fourth paragraph says entity D has elected to withhold 34 shares. My assumption in the example is that it was not actually entity D's choice upon exercise to do that. That in fact, either that was required by terms of the plan, or it was the option holder's choice. I think if it was entity D's choice, you know, they could decide each time an option is exercised, I don't think you'd have a liability at all.
Yeah, Scott is right. I mean, that was not the best word to use here.
Andrew.
So I just think that's a fundamental point. So you don't mean the company is making an election here. You're saying it's got an obligation.
Yeah, I mean, the company, according to our assumptions here, the company has got the obligation to withhold that tax, and is transferring that tax to the authority on behalf of the employee.
So, Andrew, it looks as if you're thinking then that if the company didn't have any obligation withhold any of these shares, but it does still have a practice, which I assume is built into this example, it has a practice of withholding a certain number of shares, which it then doesn't issue, in order that the value, effectively, that goes to the employee is a net number of shares and a cash payment for withholding taxes that is paid to the IRS or whoever. So it's the practice that creates the bifurcation, not the absolute discretion that it has.
If I can just clarify, at the beginning of that paragraph we say entity is obliged by tax law to withhold the amount. And so in that second sentence, the intention was that it is obliged to withhold.
Well, it's obliged to withhold the cash. It isn't obliged by law to withhold the shares. That's the point. But the practice is, in order to comply with the obligation to withhold the tax and paid over in cash, that it doesn't issue all of the shares.
Yes.
Scott?
I have a lot of familiarity with the way these things work in the U.S., and I think that's what was meant here. The tax law absolutely obliges the company to withhold. Mm-hmm. There are basically two ways the company could handle that. The first way is to issue a lower number of shares to account for the difference. The second way would be to literally withhold from the employee's paycheck other amounts, because there's no cash being paid to the employee here. It is my understanding that the situation we are dealing with is where the option arrangement with the employee either gives the employee the choice of how to handle it, or says it will be handled by issuing less shares. If the option agreement instead says, company, you can pick which way to handle it, then my sense is that under IFRS 2, there actually wouldn't be a liability, because the company could choose not to withhold through the shares. So I had read this example and the words entity D is elected. I think I had read that as being they elected when they granted the options to handle it this way, not upon exercise. It is true under U.S. GAAP, when we talk about this, there is language that says even if the plan doesn't require you to withhold more than the statutory minimum, but as a practice you do, account for the award as a liability. I don't think we have similar language under IFRS 2 to deal with there. So my assumption is that this example was a situation where at the time of exercise, the company does not have a choice. Company must settle it this way.
Ruth?
Well, that was part of my question. My question on the example, I guess, is if entity D obliged to withhold the shares or to withhold compensation? And must it pay the amount in cash? And if it must pay the amount in cash, which it must, can it choose to do so by withholding shares and selling them on the market or whatever? Or can it elect to pay it out of its own resources? I mean, the 300 that's coming in from the employee was also some concern to me. I couldn't get the journals to work. But it can use some of the 300 to pay the obligation, but then it's short, so it's got to find the cash somehow. Would it automatically sell the shares, or could it get the cash from somewhere else?
Yeah,
is the obligation to withhold the cash? I'm trying to get to what should be the amount of the compensation, I suppose, because the thing that worries me about the difference between the two examples is that in the first example, you get this whopping great debit to employee compensation, which comes from the fact that we're recognising cash outflow as a liability to the tax office, and so you get a huge amount of compensation coming through in example 7, whereas in example 7A, the amount of employee compensation is much smaller. And that's simply because of the manner of settlement. And in example 7A, we're saying that the manner of settlement is net equity settled through a cashless exercise. So the amount of compensation is very much lower than in example 7. And that's what troubles me about it. I actually agree with your analysis, and I think that it is cash settled. But what bothers me is the fact that there's this huge difference in the compensation expense that gets reflected between the two. And that may well be why the FASB decided to make an exemption in their standard.
Yeah, I would just refer you back to paragraph 5A and I and double I. And B, where we are explaining that the entity is required by the tax authority requirements to withhold from an employee's compensation an amount to satisfy the employees, is from the employee's compensation. And, well, then it would use that amount to pay the tax authority. And at the end of the day, well, the employee will receive a net number amount of shares. So the entity, in the example in Agenda Paper 7, the entity is not issued the whole amount of shares. It's not issued the 100 shares. It's just issuing a net amount. And that's the basis of our conclusions here, that the manner of settlement, at the end of the day, the entity is paying a portion in shares and a portion in cash.
Cash is at the fair value at the date of settlement, which in this case is very much higher than it was at the date of issue. The debit goes to compensation as a cost to the company at a very much higher value than it would do in example 7A.
So that's the consequence of cash settled.
Yes, so there's a huge impact on employee compensation as a result of a very fine difference in the manner of settlement. Now, and as I said, I agree with your analysis. I think technically you're right under IFRS 2. But I'm troubled by the very big difference in the accounting that was
Well, that's
a yeah. Before we go too far in here, I mean, just to remind you, we're asking the questions on the example that's been given. And what concerns me a little bit is that as you're raising questions, of course, people will read these papers later and use it as the basis for a conclusion. So it's helpful, I think, Aaron and others have been bringing up specific points about here to clarify what some of the assumptions that are unstated actually are, and we may have to think about saying, well, we'll actually publish this as a final example somewhere as educational material, which is complete and it represents everything that we're thinking about. Now, moving away for a moment from Aaron's original point as to how many shares are you really issuing, I think the other point now that Scott and one or two others are bringing up is whether or not the entity has an obligation to pay cash. That is, does it have an obligation in the arrangement to make cash payments out of this, in other words, to net settle, or does it in some way have no obligation, but it has a right to choose that in the event that the employee cannot provide the tax that needs to be paid in cash, that it will withhold some of the shares. And this must be a fact of law in the agreement. So maybe, Aaron, you could share some thoughts on that as well.
Yes, that's exactly right. I thought what I'd do is, you know, at IBM we issue equity kind of all around the globe. So we have a lot of different agreements based on the individual countries. So we did a kind of an inventory of those. And what I can tell you is that the terms of the arrangement call for 100% equity. There's nothing in the arrangement that specifically would oblige the company to sell. What happens is there's a term in the arrangement that says this arrangement will not prohibit the company from complying with local law. Right? So it's, again, you know, a very broad statement, but I think for I think Ruth's point, right, is it's not that clear in the arrangement whether there's actually an obligation on the company or not to net settle. And the reason I say that, Bob, is that if we were to change from a net settle to a gross sell, for example, we would not have to change any legal terms of the arrangement. So, you know, and we did that study with our countries, and we're pretty confident. So to the question I think that's on the table, what do the terms of the arrangement say? They say 100% equity, but we're not going to break the law.
But what gives you the right when the employee pays you the 300 strike price not to issue the employee with 100 shares?
Again, usually it would be a decision made based on simplicity, right, to reduce the administrative burden either via the practice in country, because not every country withholds, right? So you have different results. But it generally is driven by, you know, usually the company's desire to say, we don't want to have exposure to you walking away and not paying your tax liability and then being held maybe by a taxing authority. So I think the question that is on the table, and I just want to clarify, is that the terms of the arrangement do not specifically call for, you know, withholding or bifurcation. There's nothing, at least in our agreement, you won't see anything like that in the arrangement.
Okay. The ones that I was familiar with in my previous life, in fact, had a clause in that provided for the exercise of or conversion of the number of options into the full amount of shares, but that it was conditional on payment of the strike price, and it was conditional on payment in cash by the employee of the amount of tax relative to that compensation. In the event that the employee didn't pay either of those amounts, that the company, or in fact it was the share trust, had the right to withhold an equivalent number of shares at value. Circumstances were different because we actually sold them through a broker-assisted scheme, in effect, to finance that. So the company issued the gross amount of the shares. So we're in a different circumstance.
Yeah, and you'll find that, again, you got to distinguish options from restricted stock.
Yeah.
You're going to have different terms as well between the type of equity, which, again, are going to add complexity.
All right. But Denise did a very straightforward illustration on that. We want to be clear about all the facts in there. Okay, Scott?
Well, I'm just going to say I've seen options written the way Aaron's are, the way IBM's are, and I've seen options written the way you've described, and I've seen options that just say it will be net settled. So I've seen them all the different ways. And again, I think to read the example in paragraph 13 correctly, we need to assume that there is either an obligation in the arrangement to settle net, or that it's the employee's choice to settle net, or that paragraph 41 of IFRS 2 applies and it's literally the company's choice, but they have a previous practice of settling net. One of those needs to, I think, be there in order for this example to work as written.
So if we do decide that we want to represent this example, then I think those terms and conditions would be, it seems that they would be an important factor in determining the accounting. Andrew, was your light on before? No, oh, Sean, sorry.
I was on, but this was to bring our own example where we have an obligation by the tax authority to withhold. But to protect the company, we put that in the agreement with the employee that as a result of this obligation, only a certain number of shares will be issued directly to the employee and the rest will be utilized to pay the tax authority. So just to mirror what
you... Just to keep your light on for a moment, out of curiosity, you used to have in your tax code a provision that deferred the payment of the gain until the shares were actually realized. I think that was an election that employees could make. That's something I remember in the early 2000s.
Yes, there was a...
I don't know if that provision has now fallen away and it's not relevant, but in determining when the tax has to be paid over, that adds a further complication, I think, to the company. But presumably if there is a deferral, then the deferral is no longer an obligation of the company to withhold the tax.
Yeah.
The employee has made that election, and it's then purely on the individual. Yeah. Laurence?
Yeah, can I ask to Jean, in his case, whether for the purpose of governance follow-up and so on, about how many shares have been issued to employees, whether it is the net number or the gross number that's communicated?
This is not strictly relevant to the question or even the topic that we're discussing, so if you can be brief.
Yeah, both. That's the communication to the employees is the gross number entitlement and then the net shares issue.
Yeah, okay. Thanks. All right. Now, the real questions.
Yeah, the real questions. At the previous meetings, we noted that some of you expressed some concerns on the definition of a cash-settled share-based payment transaction because, in fact, apparently the definition didn't help much in concluding that this transaction could be bifurcated. Because the tax obligation remains that of an employee and the entity is settling the tax obligation on behalf of the employee. Sorry, I'm referring to question one for the committee. When applying also the agent principal analysis, you can refer that in paragraph 15 of the agenda paper, the withholding of shares and the payment of cash for the benefit of the employee, we think is in substance a cash-settled share-based payment. We are asking you now whether you agree with the views that we reach in this paper and whether you think that there is needed some clarification on the definition of cash settled share-based payment transaction to accommodate this transaction that we are analyzing today.
Aaron?
Well, I would say, first of all, this is a very important issue. This is a very common practice around the world. And we've worked with an outside vendor who actually did a survey of their IFRS filers and found that roughly 11% actually bifurcated. And so I would say that this is an issue that is very significant. I would agree with the staff that I think paragraph 34 is an acceptable analogy. And I want to just emphasize the word analogy. I don't think paragraph 34 was written with this intent to discuss this issue. And so I think it is an analogy. And I think when you're dealing with analogies, you can't limit yourself to one paragraph. You have to look at the rest of the standard. And I would summarize this question as a question of, do we account for the two transactions that are happening as one, or do we account for the two transactions separately? And let me clarify what I mean by that. Mm-hmm. The two transactions happening, in my opinion, are you have an equity award, and then you have a treasury stock transaction that the company has worked, in agreement with the company to make. So the question really is, do you view this as one net arrangement, back to then the question of how you view the 300 and all those kind of things, or do you view this as two separate transactions that happen to be settled net? And, my view then, looking at analogies, once you're talking about analogies, is to say, what is the substance of what's going on? And how we looked at this was, what do the terms of the arrangement say? Right? Let's look at the arrangement. Let's look at board authorizations. Right? When we go to the board and ask for 100, we don't then ask for 60. We ask for 100, and then we take the 100 off, and then when it's repurchased, we actually account for that repurchase against our share repurchase authorization of the board. So we actually gross bookkeep it, if that's what you want to call it. So I think, from a principle, I'm going to stay away from the practical issues that this creates, but from a conceptual basis, I think 34 is an analogy. I think that there are other analogies that are appropriate. When I look at what is developed in practice, and we've been dealing with this issue specifically for the past probably 5 years, and all the guidance we'd been given up until probably about a year ago was that there's, gross settlement was or gross accounting was appropriate. So I think that if you're in the position of, analogizing to 34, I think you have to open up the rest of the standard. Paragraph 29 deals with, a piece of that, treasury stock. You also have, 32 deals with treasury stock transactions. We know how to account for those. So that, to me, is the fundamental question. Do you want to view it as one transaction net, and then you're going to open up a host of operational issues, or do you want to deal with the terms of the arrangement, which, by the way, that's what paragraph 34 talks about, accounting for the terms of the arrangement. So do you want to account for the terms of the arrangement or not? And if you open it up to not accounting for the terms of the arrangement, I think you're going to have a host of operational issues that are I know you're going to have a host of operational issues that are going to be very difficult to handle, and I can deal with those at a later time, if anyone's interested.
It sounds like if we do the thing that you don't approve of, that you'll give us lots of questions running over the next 20 years. Scott?
Number one, I think it is one transaction that's settled in two ways, part cash, part stock. But number two, if we're going to do the analogy to issue shares and then do a treasury stock transaction, well, what we're actually issuing is puttable shares. Because we don't have a choice but to do the treasury stock transaction, and I know what the accounting for puttable shares is. And that's a liability too. So I'm willing to look at that analogy as well. I think it gives the same answer, possibly with some different measures. But an obligation to issue puttable shares is a liability.
You get the same answer in the gross settlement, 7-8, right?
So I think there's no question either way that you get a liability. I think the staff's got it right. I don't think 34 is an analogy. I think it applies. I think it's in the scope, and I think the answer is clear. I also know that the people who wrote this in think the answer is clear. They asked for an exception.
Tuck.
I
understand that we are issuing equitable shares. In this sense, we have a liability. I couldn't agree more. However, aren't we missing something very important? That is what I said, that the original purpose of the IFRS 2 is to measure the service received. The purpose is not to measure the liability. So I would say if the settlement is different, then liability occurs. And so we have to measure it. I understand that procedure technically. However, if the purpose of the IFRS 2 is to measure the service received and keep the comparability of profit or loss, it will lead completely different consequences. So that is what we should avoid. And then that's why the U.S. GAAP has an exception. And the question is, is it really exception? I don't think it's an exception. I think because the writing of IFRS 2 is a little bit poor, actually IFRS 2 may work wrongly. So then if that is the case, then we can amend it, either through the annual improvement process or a separate project or board project. Or we could wait for the post-implementation review of IFRS 2. However, post-implementation review is not planned yet. So therefore, I think it would be easier for us to make a kind of annual improvement process or either independent board amendment process. So that is necessary. Because this issue raises huge impact to the lots of companies. So we have to take it seriously. That is what I think.
But we won't go into the merits of whether it fits into post-implementation review criteria, because that will keep Michael talking for another 20 minutes. Laurence?
I'm not going to repeat many of the arguments that have already been said by Aaron, Tack, or what I already said. The point I will look at is the question asks, the staff view is that no clarification is necessary, and actually in DAF rejection, you say it does not expect diversity in practice. There is diversity in practice, and we know it. And so I do believe that a DAF rejection will not work in this case. So there is a need for clarification. I would support, in that case, what TAC is proposing, is that if we end up with something that, again, does not make sense or does not reflect the economics of the transactions that are effectively occurring, that we look beyond about what's really needed. What can be read as a simple way, again, with paragraph 34.
Thank you. John, is your light on from before, or do you want to make a comment this time? Just in case there is a particular view that you wanted to express. Ruth?
Yes, I agree with what Scott has said, and with what Tuck has said. I think technically the interpretation that the staff have applied is correct. It's hard to disagree with it. But I think the outcome is very difficult to accept in terms of the big difference you get in compensation expense. And from my memory, the very first time round that we discussed this, I thought we were going to recommend to the board that they consider introducing a similar exception to the same one that they have in US GAAP for that reason. So I would be okay with most of the gender decision with some modification, but I would say at the end that we would be recommending to the board that they create an exception to this and that we could do this via annual improvements. Because, as Scott says, that's what the FASB did. They read it this way. They came to the same conclusion. They said, gee, that doesn't make sense. We should create an exception. And I think that's what we should recommend to the board.
Well, can we leave it on making a recommendation to the board with all the other items that are coming on the next paper as to what we do with them. Otherwise, because Michael is jumping up and down because annual improvements doesn't allow us to create new exceptions. Which, to remind you, is something that we decided on at the previous meeting. So
that's true. I guess there was a proposal to allow us to. We didn't want it.
Final comment.
Well,
and then
okay, then.
It's time out.
Yeah, I do feel, though, I need to respond to the notion of the redeemable, because I don't think that's the right analysis. And the reason I say that is when you look at IFRS 2, it talks about accounting for the terms of the arrangement. And what happens is these shares are not redeemable. When you look at the legal terms of the arrangement, they are not redeemable. When you look at the fact that I could get a different answer, when you look at the 7A example, of just gross settling it and forcing, I don't know how you would get a different answer. You'd call those redeemable as well. And so I don't agree with the notion that it's as clear as we're making it on the notion of redeemable. With that said, I mean, there are, if the staff were to proceed with the drafting, I would strongly suggest that this be added to the board's list of, I think it's the next agenda paper 8, of items that need to be taken on. And if the IFRIC, and again, this is, if there's a question on whether this is the right answer, just not from what the gap, but it is the right answer, does it make sense to force your Canadian companies and everyone that is currently, again, the 80-plus percent of people that are not bifurcating, to bifurcate only to not bifurcate? And so I raise that question, and I think the problem is once you go down the path of saying, okay, this is the only answer, there are going to be a whole host of other questions that are going to come up that I think would suggest that maybe responses to them, you know, for example, in your diluted earnings per share calculation, do you use 60 or 100, right? I mean, back to this notion. In your, the deal, we have enough time, we have enough trouble dealing with employee mobility today. Now throw in the fact that rates change depending on the time of year. Are they going to exercise it in the first 100,000 of income in the U.S. and therefore it's taxed differently than on the next, and therefore I have all these issues with my. The list can go on. I have a whole page of lists, by the way, that we've created.
I won't. I
will cut myself off on that one. But I want to emphasize that, again, if we believe that something needs to be done, I would suggest that we identify that there is diversity in practice, that this is best dealt with by a more comprehensive project and not handle it in an agenda decision, because I think it will have material impacts on companies, both in the costs of implementing this to begin with, and the cost of maintaining. When I say material, very material. So I don't want to make light of it. It's a very significant work effort that you would be putting on companies to do. So I would kindly request, being that I don't have a vote, and frankly I'd appreciate the opportunity just to be here, Bob, that the agenda decision remains silent, so as not to force people to change, only to change. If that's really, truly what the board suggests, or what we think is the right answer.
Okay. You've used up your time.
I'm done.
Said my piece. But Joanna will give us a final word.
Well, despite what Aaron says, and I understand what Aaron says, and I'll come to the decision in a minute, I certainly can't fault the logic of applying the rules, and I use rules deliberately, of IFRS 2 in reaching the conclusion. But I share with others around the table the intuitive nonsense, quite frankly, of the result, of the outcome of following that, and for 7A, and that to me it epitomises, quite frankly, the rules that are in IFRS 2 and that it really does need looking at, and paper 8 talks about all those issues. I had, despite the fact that I can't fault the logic personally, and Aaron obviously has a different view, I do believe that what we have got written in the tentative decision is an interpretation. And I think we need to be extraordinarily careful about that, because we are effectively saying this requires, therefore, it to be a cash-based settlement. And I think we can't, you know, I absolutely agree. I'm not sure I would be completely silent that Aaron is saying, but I absolutely agree that last bit in the middle paragraph, we cannot say, because that is an interpretation. So we need to be more ambivalent around that, but I would support us going the route of doing something but being more ambivalent, but absolutely adding it to the list that's in Agenda Paper 8.
Okay, Denise, you've been very convincing, very persuasive with your paper. You've raised a lot of questions and a lot of interest. The sense I have is that the majority of the members agree with the analysis that you performed. I don't mean it pejoratively, but on a technical basis and a logical basis, that you've come to a conclusion that most people would support and agree with. But there are many of you who've said that you would like the board to do something. The way that the agenda decision is worded at the moment implies really that the matter is closed. We've looked at it and that's the end of it, and it goes no further. This is an issue that I think you're suggesting that we take to the board in one of its various guises, but I'd recommend that the way in which we carry it forward is with the other items, if any, that come out of the discussion of the next paper, which then leaves us with the question of what do we say about our agenda decision. We decided not to take it onto the agenda, but perhaps, Aaron, we, even though you're not an official member of the committee, we might even believe that you have given us some evidential matter in the assertion that your service providers, say 11% of the people, bifurcate, and the presumption is that presumably the other 89% don't.
There's some gross settlement there as well.
But yeah. But that there are a variety of different circumstances with slight nuances could give rise to significant, and I wouldn't say distortions, but different arithmetic calculations of the amount of compensation expense. And so perhaps, TAC, as this is something that you and your new guys will also be involved in, then your words of saying that the focus of IFRS 2 is on recognizing the compensation expense, and a subset of that is only then to recognize the way in which that compensation expense is financed, and that we don't disturb the relationship of compensation to what it's meant to be compensating for, that if the board decides to take on a project on this issue, that on IFRS 2, that is broadly, that they consider this question of the tax withholding. I'm sure that Aaron believes this is not an exception that is required. Let's not even think about that. If you get the answer you're looking for, then be happy. and I suppose to the extent that in your wisdom, you and Philippe and Weguo decide not to do anything about this, with Alan's concurrence, of course, that some people, like US domestic companies adopting IFRS for the first time in 2014, will come back to us with another question, and that the committee will have to reconsider it then. So we have to decide what the agenda wording is going to be, something perhaps not quite as definitive.
Mm-hmm.
Your examples were very persuasive, Denise. Don't take it as a negative on that, but in order to go out to the rest of the world, I'm perhaps a little concerned that we may be requiring a change to current accounting practice by bifurcating, that may be something that is changed in 2 or 3 years' time. It's unfortunate that this standard does contain a lot of rules, and the imposition of the rules means that for a slight tweak you get a very different accounting result. The sensible thing, of course, Aaron, would be to say to you, why don't you just get broker-assisted transactions on all of this, and that US government should legislate that brokers participating in these transactions wouldn't charge you any fees. and that there would be no taxes paid on this transaction or anything else, and the financial institutions involved would do it out of the goodness of their heart.
Yeah, you know, honestly, the fees aren't the big issue, Bob. I mean, the fees, to be very candid, we'll pass on to the employee.
Yeah.
That's not the point.
You are on record.
Yeah, I am on record. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's $40. You know, you're getting a million options. You know, who $40 you can handle.
Okay.
The real issue from a U.S. is just on how you'd operationalize it around companies that are thinly traded. There are certain companies that are either private or thinly traded that just can't go to gross settle. For us, the big issue is around blackout periods. I've talked to our legal teams, and they believe while we can plan around press releases and, you know, earnings releases, we can't plan around acquisitions and such. And so we just don't want to be in the position of issuing, Form 8Ds, stating that, you know, employee or executive A decided to break the law and issue or exercise awards when at the end of the day it was for a tax withholding. That's the big issue would prevent us. And again, we were debating just going to that, and my lawyer said no, we're not going for that reason.
So the 7A approach wouldn't actually help you. There are still other operational
issues. I'm hoping I can get my lawyers to. to agree, but right now there's a lot of pushback because they just don't want to be, you know, hiring someone to issue 8Ds all the time.
Okay. Ruth?
Just a suggestion for the agenda decision then, following on what Joanna said, could we just leave it as the first paragraph as it is and then simply say that the Interpretations Committee decided not to take the issue onto the agenda, but to refer it to the board and leave it at that. And depending upon what we say in Agenda Paper 8, we can have a little bit more wording around what to refer to the board or how to refer it to the board, but just leave it at that.
All right, well, Michael and Denise, would you be happy to sort of reflect on what this middle paragraph would be limited to saying, so we can think about that.
Okay.
All right. So would anybody object to the approach where we effectively neutralize paragraph 2? Paragraph 3, of course, would now not note that IFRS 2 provides sufficient guidance, but that would instead say that it's the decision of the committee to refer or to recommend that the board consider this together with the, whatever we're saying for the other items in paper 8, mm-hmm. issues that have been raised with us over the years that we think the board should consider reacting to, and the way in which it should do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
All right, nobody objects. We can then move on to paper 8.